copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
It's a real privilege to be with you this afternoon, and speaking on this topic, which I think is a kind of hugely important one for the kind of age that we live in, and the age that we're communicating, and the age that we're trying to do theology in. And as somebody remarked, you know, if the 18th century saw the start of the first machine age, as it's been called, with the Industrial Revolution and things like the steam engine and this kind of stuff. Really now, where we are in the 21st century, we are living in the early years of the second machine age, where digital technology is doing for our mental limitations what the steam engine did for our muscular limitations. And as computer technology and computer power has surged forward, as digital technology has been applied to more and more fields, it does sort of seem increasingly that there are no limits to what digital technology can do and to what computers can be applied to. And enjoy these benefits. Here we are on Zoom having a virtual conference. We couldn't have done that a few years ago. You know, we love our digital devices, and without the internet, we might struggle to fill our time and actually have to do something radical like talk to people. But there's also a hallmark, I think, of the second machine age that is perhaps a little more troubling, and we're going to touch on as we go this afternoon. And that's the tendency that we have as human beings to believe that technology can solve every problem. And we could point to lots of examples to illustrate that, but let me just give you just one that I think shows some of the questions that technology raises. And it was a few years ago now, about 8 years ago, that IBM launched a brand new supercomputer that they nicknamed Watson. And Watson became a celebrity very much in its own right. When some of you may remember that Watson appeared on a TV quiz show, the popular American TV quiz show Jeopardy, and it actually beat two of the previous champions of that quiz show. And many people at that were stunned, because surely something like a quiz show, it was reasoned, that requires all kinds of skills unique to human beings. Surely that wouldn't be something that a computer could master and, in fact, better human beings at. Now, despite all of the hoopla and noise and attention that Watson's success achieved, on one level, what the computer was doing was not particularly remarkable. It analyzed each question that was asked. It searched a massive database of documents. It generated a list of possible answers to each question, and then it just ranked them in terms of probability. But Watson could do this so quickly and so rapidly that it could outthink exceptionally smart human beings in a game of trivia. Now, IBM, since that happened, have begun applying Watson to medical diagnoses, and their vision is just that it beat human Jeopardy players. It won't be too long before Watson is beating human doctors at their own game. But technology like that raises all kinds of questions, right? Is what Watson is doing thinking? Is computing a metaphor for the mind? When we think as human beings, are we doing what computers do, just a bit more slowly but more complexly? Or to put it very bluntly, are human beings just meat computers? And questions like that that technology is raising in our culture all the time are in some ways actually just gateways to even bigger questions. As the journalist William Powers wrote, reflecting on the whir of activity that our smartphones and tablets and wearable digital devices encourage, he wrote these words. He said, when you start wondering about your own busyness that kind of digital technology brings upon you, when you start wondering about your own busyness, pretty soon you're pondering much deeper questions. Questions like, is this the kind of life I really want? And from there, it's just a short hop to the big league existential stumpers. Why are we here and who am I? And it's fascinating that even non-religious journalists are being forced to ask spiritual questions by the way that technology is changing our society. And that question that William Powers raises there about the nature of what life is all about, the nature of the good life, is a particularly fascinating question for us to think about, because our culture, I think, increasingly advertises the idea that the answer to that question, what does the good life look like, is simply better and better technology. You know, our culture tells us that technology is the panacea for all that ails us. Just think about the number of personal digital devices that are sold this way. Aspirationally, we're told that if you buy this phone, this tablet, this device, this app, they'll help solve all of your problems. They'll get you fit, they'll get you organized, they'll get you better connected, they'll make you smarter. And interestingly, the myth that technology is a solution for everything that's wrong in the world is not new. It's pretty much been our approach to technology throughout history. You know, it's fascinating to look back through history and notice that when some of the technologies that we now take for granted, that are now pretty much ubiquitous, when they were first invented and first marketed, the way they were sold is interesting. So when commercial radio began in the 1920s, early adverts for radio promised how it would revolutionize our lives, it would connect people, it would even break down barriers between nations, companies like Marconi boasted. When the car and when the motor car took off in the 1900s, similar utopian promises were made of how it would set people free. One of my favorites, when television was invented in the 1930s, it was much the same. You can see on your screen there an early advert from Motorola telling you that television benefits your children and will produce children who are kinder and more generous and have better marks at school. I can almost hear the hollow laughs, even though you've got your audio turned off. And it was the same in the 1970s and the 1980s with personal computers. Again, one of my favorite adverts from the era is Apple's advert for the Apple II personal computer. And when that was launched, the headline ran this way: Jefferson had one of the best minds in 1776, but today you can make better decisions with an Apple. And it's interesting that every case of a new technology being introduced, you can kind of see the same pattern, that the benefits of the technology are seized upon. But as human beings, we're not always very good at spotting perhaps the costs of that technology. And every technology has a cost. Consider the car, for example. For sure, the motor car unlocked cheap, easy transportation for everybody. But it also led to the paving over of vast amounts of green space, the reshaping of our cities around it, with pedestrians marginalized in the process. If you throw in environmental pollution, and what our insatiable thirst for petroleum has done over the years to the Middle East, then maybe the picture is just a little bit more complex. Maybe we can have to be a bit more reflective. And it's an interesting question to ask: was the invention or a mass production of the car, was that a good thing or a bad thing? As the historian of technology, David Noble, writes, he says, technology leads a bit of a double life, one which conforms to the intention of the designers, and another one which contradicts them, proceeding behind the backs of their architects to yield unintended consequences and unintended possibilities. And, you know, it's easy to laugh at the naivety of our ancestors for the way they thought about things like cars and TV and radio, this slightly naive approach to technology. But I would argue that today we are potentially repeating the pattern as societies when it comes to digital technology, largely because I think it's blindsiding us because it has and is changing the world so fast. And one of the things that I think goes on in society is when technology changes rapidly, it can sometimes outstrip our ability to keep up. And digital technology continues to grow at an incredibly rapid pace. It's a couple of factors in particular that have led to that growth. I'll just talk about one of them for a couple of minutes, and then we're going to move into exploring some of the theological and apologetic questions that flow out of this. But one of the big factors that's driven digital technology has been the exponential improvement of computers. The gentleman on the slide share there, his name is Gordon Moore. And in 1965, Gordon Moore, who was the co-founder of Intel, the microprocessor design company, he made a now very famous prediction. He observed that the number of components on an integrated circuit was doubling every year. And he predicted that would continue to be the case for the next 10 years. And then he revised it to it would double every 2 years. And that doubling observation has become known as Moore's Law, and he's basically been proven right. And that doubling of power, you know, year in, year out, for a technology is almost unique. We don't know of any other area of technology where that's happened, but it has happened in digital technology. And to just put that in perspective, imagine what would happen if cars got twice as fast every year. Or imagine that aeroplanes became twice as efficient every year. Or imagine if by careful physical training, you could halve your time to run a marathon every year. That kind of constant doubling of performance is unthinkable, yet it's happened in digital technology year after year after year. Well, in those the kind of 10 minutes or so we've been going so far, I've given you a bit of background, and I think background is helpful here to kind of paint a bit of a background in which we can now begin to fill some detail in. And what I want to do in my remaining kind of 18 minutes or so is use that background to raise some theological and apologetic and perhaps missional questions, especially questions about how digital technology impacts on an absolutely crucial question, the whole question of what it means to be a human being. And as a way into that question, it's worth thinking about one of the reasons I think we have some issues around technology is we have a slightly ambivalent relationship with work, beautifully illustrated actually in the Dilbert cartoon strip, which I've given you an example there. If I'm boring you with my talk, you can chuckle at Dilbert for a couple of minutes. And we have a strange relationship with work as human beings. Most human beings, if you ask them, will tell you that they think they want less work. If you ask people, you know, would you like to work more or work less? Most people say they would like that their labor reduced, they'd like more leisure time to be free to do whatever we want. But there was a groundbreaking survey done at the University of Chicago a few years ago, which tracked a group of workers from a whole range of professions over a week. And what this survey discovered was that most people actually felt more happy and more fulfilled by what they did at work than during their leisure hours, when they often reported feeling bored or anxious. Yet at the same time, in the same survey to the same researchers, they were reporting they didn't actually want to be at work in the first place. And that study picked up something that the psychologists who did the study coined miswanting, which is this tendency we have as human beings to desire things we don't like, and to like things we don't desire. And boy, there's a theological question raised right there, isn't there? And all of this warns us, though, that when it comes to digital technology and the slightly kind of siren call we hear from digital technology that tells us things like, hey, you must have this digital device, you must have this phone, this tablet, this smartwatch, because it will save you time and give you more leisure, maybe we need to be just a little bit careful. And we're right back at this question of what the good life looks like. What is it that human beings were created to be? And of course, one part of the biblical answer to that question is we were created by God to work as well as to rest. You know, work gives us a structure. It gives us a purpose. It gives us clear goals and challenges that endless leisure time doesn't. And so when along comes a shiny new invention like the Google car, for example, and Google promised when that technology is perfected, it will free us from, quote, the work of driving and give us more leisure time, maybe we need to think very carefully about whether that's actually what we really want. Now, of course, to ask the question, what does the good life look like, is to ask the question of what it means to be a human being in the first place. Are we just meat computers, as the MIT artificial intelligence pioneer Marvin Lee Minsky once famously put it? Are human beings just meat computers with the software of our souls running on the hardware of our bodies? Increasingly, our culture answers yes to that question, but maybe there's been a confusion sown to some degree by our metaphors. Listen to these powerful words from Raymond Tallis. Raymond is an interesting character. He's an atheist, committed atheist, doesn't believe in God. But he would share many of our concerns about technology and its tendency to reduce human beings to just the parts they're made of. And I love this little paragraph from his book, Aping Mankind, Neuromania, Darwinitis, and the Misrepresentation of Humanity. Raymond says the confusion begins with the way that we talk about machines. We don't smile with disbelief when we're told that the camera sees a scene. or that radar searches for the enemy, or a smart bomb hunts down its target, a photoelectric cell detects the background luminescence and instructs the camera shutter to open or close, or when we're told an electronic probe reports the presence of something or other. We are all perfectly aware that none of these devices would do these things, seeing, searching, hunting down, detecting, instructing, reporting, in the absence of conscious human beings. But we start imagining that these machines that help us carry out certain functions actually have those functions. This is particularly likely to happen when the machines in question are computers. And the idea he's nudging at here is that each time we use one of those metaphors, we reinforce the idea that computers are smart, that they can think. But the problem is, as we raise computers up, we drag ourselves, we drag humanity down in the process. But it's actually questionable whether human beings will ever, whether computers will ever do any kind of actual thinking, no matter how much we develop them. And in fact, back in the 1980s, there was a famous thought experiment designed to help illustrate this point. And the philosopher John Searle offered a very powerful illustration as to why computers are never going to think in the way that human beings do. And in his illustration, he said, let's imagine a man locked inside a room. It's not COVID-19, but he's in lockdown anyway. And there he is inside his little room. And in the door is a letterbox through which messages may be posted. And outside the box, a Chinese speaker is writing questions on slips of paper and posting them through the letterbox. Now, the key thing is that the man inside the box doesn't speak Chinese. What he does is he picks up the slip of paper, he looks at the question, he looks at the Chinese characters that are written, and he looks up those characters in a large book that he has that tells him which characters he should write in return. And he writes his response and he posts it back outside the box to a Chinese speaker outside. Now, John Searle said, the interesting thing in that illustration is the Chinese speaker outside the room thinks that the man inside the box can understand Chinese because he's asked questions in Chinese, he's received an answer in Chinese. But in reality, there is no comprehension. The man inside the room is simply following an algorithm. He's following a program even, but he has absolutely no comprehension. And that, said John Searle, is what computers do. A powerful computer can give you the illusion of understanding. We type a question into Google, it gives us the answer, but there's no understanding going on. The computer hasn't understood the question, it hasn't thought, it hasn't reasoned. It simply followed a predefined set of steps. Indeed, you could program a computer to respond to the question, what is pi, with the numbers 3.141, and so on, or it might respond to the question, what is pi, with the words a wet fish. And the computer wouldn't know the difference. It wouldn't know one answer is wrong, one answer is right. It's just following its programming. And I think we need to reflect very hard, actually, as Christians, on what our society is trying to say about humanity when it constantly makes these comparisons between being human and being a computer. Well, I want to raise two other big questions for us theologically that the digital age raises. I may not necessarily give you all the answers, but I'll hopefully give you some food for thought, some grist for the theological mill. And the first question I want to just push into a little bit harder is one we've just touched on, and it is this whole idea of personhood. What does it mean to be a human being? And you see, underlying so much of the computer industry and affecting more or less everything that the media ever reports to do with computers is a philosophy. And that philosophy has been described by Yaron Lanier, who is one of the fathers of modern computing, and in fact, arguably is the gentleman who invented virtual reality. And Yaron Lanier, in his book, You Are Not a Gadget, describes what he calls the philosophy of computationalism, the idea that the world is just another computational process, and human beings are just sub-processes. And the idea behind this philosophy that is everywhere in our culture is that if you throw enough computing power at it, computers will one day take on personal qualities such as consciousness. And to give an illustration of people who think like this, in 2007, a little over 10 years ago, at the American Association for the Advancement of Science annual conference, the co-founder of Google, Larry Page, said these words, and he wasn't joking, he was pretty much serious. He said, if you look at your programming, if you look at your DNA, it's about 600 megabytes compressed, smaller than any modern operating system, smaller than Linux or Windows, And that includes booting up your brain. So your program algorithms probably aren't that complicated. Intelligence is probably more about overall computation. Of course, the problem with this is it represents a pretty deeply reductionist view of human beings. And in fact, theologically, I've often wondered whether we're almost seeing a kind of new Gnosticism developing with some of this. The idea that human beings become just information, just pieces of data, points on the social graph. To be a human being is no longer to be embodied and physical. It's far more concerned about what goes on up here, because that's what we're trying to replicate with things like artificial intelligence and so on. And I think, of course, as Christians, we need to be asking some profound questions here, because the Christian worldview says that you are not merely your thoughts, not merely a disembodied mind. The Christian worldview says that we are persons, people, mind, body, and soul. And the physical is essential because God designed us that way. To bear the image of God is to be physical and embodied. And of course, when God stepped into the world in the person of Jesus, he didn't come as an idea or as a book or as a concept, but he came as a person, an embodied human being. And I think it's becoming ever more important that Christians become some of the torchbearers in pushing back on some of this deeply reductionist view in our culture of what a human being actually is. So that's the first digital question I want to raise with you for a few minutes. Second one I just want to touch on for a few moments that I think is incredibly important in our culture, and probably affects many of us, actually, because we're part of that culture. And that's the whole question of depth and space. You know, many of us, and I put my hand up here as one who is incredibly guilty, many of us live these days vicariously through our screens, you know, constantly plugged into the internet, our attention constantly in demand from our phones and our gadgets and our digital watches and so on and so forth. And one of the big questions I think our society is grappling with, and again, Christians are not immune from this, is the whole question of how do we think deeply when so many ideas are jostling for our attention? You know, the internet now delivers so much information that our problem is managing it. In fact, a fun fact for you, Google have now indexed on their computer servers over 100 petabytes of data. Now, what's a petabyte? I imagine that's not a word most of you are familiar with or use in everyday conversation. Well, to help you, it is one followed by 15 zeros after it. Or to put it into an analogy that brings it home, if you were to take Google's search index and you were to read your way through it at 250 words a minute, it would take you 4 × 10^13 years to read it, which is longer than the age of the universe. Now, theologically, among other things, of course, that causes us to wonder at the mind of God, for whom even that amount of data is absolutely minuscule. But for us mere mortals, how do we process that amount of information? Our old friend Larry Page, the co-founder of Google, once said that when Google can perfectly answer every question we throw at it, we will have achieved artificial intelligence. But I wonder whether as Christians and as theologians, we'd want to be saying that intelligence isn't simply knowing the right answer, it's also knowing the framework into which that answer sits. But the bigger question for me as an evangelist and apologist, though, is how do we do mission and evangelism and apologetics, Christian communication, in this kind of culture, an age in which facts are everywhere, people are distracted and deluged by information? How do we respond and engage as Christians? Well, certainly, I think one thing that's crucially important is we avoid presenting God as just one more fact among a galaxy of facts. People are swimming in a sea of facts. What they want to know is the bigger story that pulls those facts together. Yet I do wonder sometimes if even as deeply committed Christians, we are guilty of living this way. You know, God, if we're not careful, can become just somebody we read blogs about, that we tweet about. Yet as somebody memorably put it, you know, Jesus is not seeking Facebook fans or Facebook friends, but he's seeking disciples. And likewise, I think many of our friends and neighbors and colleagues who have no faith in Christ, they are seeking depth and wisdom amidst the smog of data that is everywhere. How, as Christian leaders and thinkers and communicators, can we help people find it amidst all that deluge and digital noise that's around us? Well, as I draw these threads together for you and we move into either some Q&A or some discussion, I want to leave you with this final thought. You know, whenever changes in communication come, they change culture profoundly. We see that through history. When writing was invented, it changed culture tremendously. When the printing press was invented, it changed culture tremendously. When the telegraph was invented, the telephone, and now digital technology. Whenever changes in technology affect communication, they often turn the world upside down. But also looking back through history, I'm reminded of the fact that Christians have always been at our best when we have not just used technology, but we've helped people think reflectively about it. You know, it's interesting when you look back through history, again, the way that Christians were very quick to embrace communication technology. You know, think of the printing press and how rapidly Christians leapt on board and began printing Bibles. Look back to the first century and the codex, where manuscripts were no longer on a roll, but cut together and sewn together to form books. That technology was not invented by, but popularized by Christians. Christians have always been at our best when we've embraced technology, but not just embraced it, when we've thought reflectively and critically about it. The internet has changed culture faster than any invention to date. And it is vital that we don't just leap on board and go, fantastic, we can now have meetings on Zoom, but also that we begin thinking theologically and biblically and apologetically, both about how to use technology well and communicate clearly in the digital age, but also to ask good questions and to engage with the questions that people are asking ever more loudly as technology raises them. You know, there are no simple answers when it comes to digital technology and some of the profound questions it raises about things like personhood and depth and space. On my website that I put into the chat for you there, I linked to a couple of resources, one book and one brilliant article, both by non-Christians, but very sympathetic to spiritual things, exploring some of those questions in more detail. You might want to take a look. Certainly, some of the questions that they and other writers raise are great themes to start conversations. And some of those conversations might center around what the good life looks like. You know, if we are living in a digital culture that doesn't support the things that we value and treasure, then maybe it's vital for all of us, not just Christians, but for Christians to be taking the lead into the conversation, to be really pushing back and asking how that culture can be rebuilt and reshaped. I remember having a very interesting conversation a couple of years ago. I did an open forum, an evangelistic event based around some of the themes that we've talked about this afternoon. And a really interesting Q&A. And at the end of the event, a gentleman came up to speak to me. And as we were talking, he began breaking down in tears. And he began telling me his story. He was a lawyer, quite a successful lawyer in the city that I was speaking in, but was feeling so incredibly overwhelmed by the fact his phone was pinging all the time. He couldn't escape from the kind of workload and the digital noise that was coming through. It was affecting his own mental health, affecting his family. And as we shared, the verse that the Lord put onto my heart was the one that was on the screen here. Come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy laden. And so we had a great conversation opportunity to pray together. But as I came away from that encounter, that question ringing in my ears, what does it look like to our friends, our neighbors, our colleagues who are digitally overwhelmed to find that rest that Jesus talks about? What does that promise look like applied to the digital world that we find ourselves in? Well, I've probably raised more questions than answers in the last half hour. I hope some of what I've shared is helpful, giving you some food for thought around what some of the questions are, some of the issues are, and about some of the ways we need to begin thinking theologically as we engage this world of technology. And it's been a privilege to share with you this afternoon.